House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. We have two items on our agenda this morning, HB 75, about contribution to PFD audits and the university, and we have HB 10, about executive ethics, legal fees, and family travel. And so we're going to hear HB 75 first, and yes, and call the roll, please. You anticipate.
Mr. Millett, not present. Representative Price Hopkins.
Here.
Representative Gaddis.
Here.
Representative Hughes.
Here.
Representative Isaacson.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Chair Lynn.
Here.
These are all
online. And we have some folks online here, too. I'm going to ask the folks for HB 75 to come up first. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. Thank you. My name is Representative Paul Seaton. I represent House District 30 now, which is from...
And I miss you on our House State Affairs Committee.
I was going to mention that it seemed different being on this side of the table.
It always does.
Mr. Chairman, HB 75 is a bill that is seeking to correct a provision that was originally established in the PIC Click Give program, which is, as you're all aware, a program that is to allow residents of Alaska who receive the permanent fund an easy way to make donations to nonprofits in their areas to support philanthropic and community-based issues and services that they support. And so that's the purpose of it. The current program exempts all nonprofits that are under $250,000 budget from an audit requirement. When we say audit requirement, I want to be clear that the audit requirement here was a CPA audit requirement, with just a financial audit, not a IRS audit. The IRS looks to make sure that people are or that nonprofits are qualified by using the 990 form, which is a 12-page form that you have in your packet. That was revised in 2008 to take into a whole lot of things more than just looking at your income and your expenses and making sure the numbers match. The 990, what it does is it also goes and looks at conflicts of interest, governance, and those kind of things, and those are available to every donor through the IRS website. So the governance situations and making sure that funds are being administered properly is done through the IRS 990. So the current requirement that says that if you are over $250,000 gross budget, you have to do a CPA audit was very problematic for a lot of nonprofits, because if you're $260,000 total budget, and it costs you $7,000 to $12,000 to $15,000 to get a CPA to come in and do a financial audit, it's a high burden. It's a lot of money. The purpose of nonprofits is to accomplish their missions, not to employ CPAs. CPA audits, of course, are best practices. Nobody denies that. But the question is, should the state of Alaska require a CPA audit from a small entity just to allow people to donate to that entity? And the other thing about these are that it's a checkbox on the form. They're not reviewed by the state of Alaska. So you do a CPA audit, what shows up was, is there a box on the form to apply? And if you check that, you did the CPA audit and spent, you know, $7,000 to $15,000 on this, you check a box and they're not looked at. So, and you wouldn't expect a donor that is looking for small donations to different organizations through the PIC Click Give program to be going in and trying to go through a CPA financial audit. They would go to the 990, which every nonprofit is required to do. So this, although CPA audits are great and they are required of any nonprofits that's large enough to have a over $500,000 federal grant, But you're talking about much larger nonprofits, and why should we disadvantage the smaller nonprofits by having this onerous requirement on them that isn't on larger nonprofits until they reach $500,000 in federal funds? So, Mr. Chairman, that's the balance that we're seeking here, is to make it available. One other poor outcome was that when people didn't qualify for the pick, click, give list, there was a lot of people that interpreted, not seeing them on that list, that they had actually lost their nonprofit standing. And so then people that were typically donating any through other means, and then we're just going to add a little extra through pick, click, give, all of a sudden there was this public confusion. So that's another reason to get rid of this. You've seen a lot of advertising around the state. The entities that are involved, Rasmussen, United Way, and all are trying to make it very available for people to donate to the organizations that they support, and they're happy to have more nonprofits participate in this program. It's not that they want to limit any number of people in the program, nonprofits that would qualify. The other portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is the University of Alaska. There was an oversight when the bill was created, the way the language was. All of the nonprofits pay a $250 administration fee to help administer the program, but the University of Alaska campuses were kind of left out of that administration fee. They don't mind paying, and they've testified that they don't mind paying the being a participant in the administration fee as well as everybody else. So that's corrected in this bill as well. And that's, Mr. Chairman, really all the bill does. Like I say, the 990 was revised in 2008 to look at it so they would look at the governance of nonprofits, and that gives the ability of the public to search out and make sure they're giving to a nonprofit that they that has adequate governance and doesn't have conflicts of interest.
Was the purpose of the audit, one of the main purposes, to determine if this was in fact a legitimate charity? In other words, two or three of us here could come up with 501c3, society to protect petunias or something, and it'd just be a sham. We're going to pick, click, give, and we get money we shouldn't. Did that have anything to do with this, that type of thing?
No, Mr. Chairman. A CPA audit is a best practice, but it's simply a looking at the finances. It's not looking at the governance and those kind of things. Those are taken care of in the 990 form and conflict of interest. I mean, it's just looking at your expenses and whether you correctly recorded them. It's not going and saying a CPA audit doesn't look at, should that expense have been made? They're looking at finances and balancing the books. I mean, so essentially that wasn't the purpose. It is considered a best practice, and nobody disagrees with that. It's just that when you're enabling small donations to be made, do you want to have a burden that is sometimes four times the amount of the donations that you're going to receive? And that's been the case, and we have a couple of people online to testify about those. This originally came to me from a complaint from the Senior Citizen Center in Seward. They were going to, I think their audit was going to be $12,000, and they were getting $3,000 to $4,000 in donations, which are very helpful to a small nonprofit to provide services within their community. And these are all donations by community members that know the nonprofits. And but to pay four times the amount that you're going to get from donations for the CPA audit, just especially when it's a checkbox to the state. All they do is check, did you do this CPA audit? They don't review it at all. So best practices for individual nonprofits, but those are decisions that need to be made in relationship to what does the nonprofit want need to do with its money? Does it provide services, or does it...
It has nothing to do whatsoever with the legitimacy of the nonprofit. We just set up a nonprofit for as some kind of a sham, and we don't get audited.
That would be an IRS kind of audit. That would be for a fraud or sham. That would not be the CPA audit, which is what our requirement is for a CPA audit. So it is not for that purpose.
We have online. We'll call just a little bit. We have Kathleen Light online from the Ketchikan Arts and Humanities. We also have Jordan Marshall, Investments and Family. Representative Gaddis, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I know that when I give to charities, I like to know where the money's going. So my question is, in regards to this audit, was it open to the public? Is that the reason that the audit originally happened? Or is there another audit, or is it up to the nonprofit to be able to let the public know where their monies or where their charitable contributions have gone? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what the beyond the best practices, which I totally get, what the other purpose of the audit could be. So, was it an audit that was open to the public?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to get my staff or the Rasmussen up here for the public openness of the audit. So I could introduce my staff.
Hello, Heather Beck, staff to Representative Seaton. Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, both the 990 and CPA audits do report some program activities of nonprofits. It's far more detailed in IRS 990. Both documents are open to the public, though the 990 is far more easily accessible. With the revisions in 2008, nonprofits are penalized $20 a day every day after 5 days that they would refuse giving a 990 to a donor, whereas the CPA audit is something that is an internally managed file, but they should give it rather than they're forced to give it and penalized for not giving it like the 990.
And just as a follow-up, I think in my mind, I think of Red Cross, who I think is a great program, but I can remember there was a time when folks thought that they were donating money for specific, and I think we all can remember, a specific disaster, and they found out that it went elsewhere. And I was just wondering if that's what this audit did, is it clarified for those who donated how the money was spent? And what I'm hearing you say is not necessarily in the audit.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Keller, Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Seaton, for bringing this bill through the process the second time. That's a lot of work, and Heather, I see you have inherited it, and that's great. My question can anyone with a 501c3 be eligible to get on Pick, Click, Give? If you form a 501c3 and you're willing to file a Form 990, is that the eligibility criteria?
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'd like to pass that to my staff as well.
That's why I have staff, too.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, there are other requirements. There's a residency requirement for board members to be Alaskans, and a number of other, you know, you must have a treasurer, and if the 4-acre group wants to respond to each individual requirement, there are more than just being a 501c3, but every organization must be a 501c3, and that's why we feel the 990 is the best accountability.
All right.
Then what is the status of UA? I mean, University of Alaska is not a 501c3, so evidently that's specified in the statute?
It is specified in the statute.
Are there other eligibility criteria in statute other than UA? Are there entities that are authorized? Can I ask a series? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you engage in a bit of a back-and-forth conversation? It'd make it easier.
Thank you. I just did that automatically and violated my own rules.
Believe the University of Alaska
is
the only other exception, but the 4-acre group would be online, too.
Okay. I want to just stop and say I support Paul. I support Representative Seaton. I support you getting this through. It's a criteria that isn't realistic. But it goes back to Representative Lynn's original question, I think. And that is, I believe that the audit became an eligibility requirement because the standard, the bar was so high. So now that we're taking that bar away, you know, that's okay. As long as, I think it's great, as long as everybody gets a fair shake here, and are we really prepared to make sure that everybody can apply on equal terms? I mean, I was thinking of, for example, public schools. You know, they aren't 501c3. And my question is, I wonder why we didn't do that in statute. You know, and I'm seeing bigger issues coming out of that. And then I got thinking about things like religious nonprofits and what have you, and thinking, you know, if you know how that the eligibility is required, because 501c3s, at least they weren't. I realize there's been changes with the IRS, but they weren't that difficult. I've done one myself, you know, a number of years ago. So if you would respond, please.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Keller, the general purpose of this is to allow an easy way for people to do small donations. And generally, they're going to be doing those within their community and to organizations they know. That is, you know, this isn't a really big pool of money. It's a portion of a PFD. I mean, someone could give all their PFD. If you have people that are generally making donations, they're making them anyway without, you know, this is just an additional way for people to direct some of their money. There's no reason, there's no tax advantage for them doing it through here. It's just an easy way for them to do it. I mean, they can take their PFD and they can write a check. They can donate in, or they can call and put it on a credit card. They can do all those things. So what the this program is to provide easy access for people to make donations to groups they want to. There's a large number of groups, and generally in the program, people are going to be donating to community organizations, to named organizations that they know. It's possible that somebody would go down and just pick names off that they randomly don't know, but this was an easy way. This whole program is to provide ease for people to donate to small organizations. The artificial cutoff of, okay, you're a really small organization, what you're talking about, three or four people, they're already exempt, forming a 501(c). Anything under $250,000 annual budget is exempt under the Pick, Click, Give program. This just kicks in if your budget is over $250,000, which is senior centers, arts councils, those kind of things that aren't big, but I mean, when you talk about $250,000, $260,000, $280,000, you're talking about not very many employees. You're not, you know, you're trying to provide services within the community. So, I don't think that we are looking at the situation that you were talking about, and I hope I've answered your question, but I got a little lost in the weeds.
That's all right, I really understand, having been in that hot seat many times myself. But no, you missed it. I do understand that this bill removes the requirement for the CPA audit on just a certain group of people that want to be on there. The question I'm trying to raise is, obviously there's a benefit for being on Pick, Click, Give. And if we make it very easy for the smaller ones to be on there, are we prepared to handle that? In other words, I think that's a great idea. I can see myself, you know, going through and finding the charity of my choice, you know, especially if it included some of the local groups. And if it only costs $250 to get on to this Pick, Click, Give, then that's a very much a feasible option, you know, for charities, you know, to do that. And I just want to make sure that we're prepared and that we're setting an equal a basis for people to qualify to be on Pick, Click, Give. Not, okay, that's my question.
And through the chair, Representative Keller, what we're getting rid of is the inequality. We have equality for anybody under $250,000. There is no audit requirement. It's only if you have $250,000 or above, then you are restricted by this requirement that generally means that you're going to have to spend more money for the audit than you will receive from this program through individual donations of Alaskans and community members. So that we're getting rid of that discrimination between saying, oh, at $240,000 or $250,000 and below, you don't have an audit requirement. But if you're above that, oh, now you have this onerous financial requirement that means you got to spend more than you're probably going to receive. And so that's what we're getting rid of. So I think that that equality is where we are.
Just to wrap up, again, I understand that. Yeah, I would like to just get some assurance, you know, that the permanent fund process is equipped to handle the whole broad spectrum of people that might apply as a result. I don't remember any testimony on that. Maybe I just missed it and it was in a different committee, and I'm sorry, but that's one I'd like to.
And through the chair, Representative Keller, we do have Rasmussen online and the State of Alaska Permanent Fund, our Department of Revenue, is in the audience that they can answer that question. But all our contacts have been is that they are not concerned about letting a few more nonprofits that are over $250,000 that are resident and have the resident board members and all that meet all those qualifications be on this list. That there has been no expression that is going to be burdensome or that administratively they can't handle that in any way.
Thank you very much. Next, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, thanks for bringing this forward. Since it's my first year, I haven't seen the history before, but I like this. In fact, it may help us in other applications, because a lot of small organizations that provide a benefit to Alaskan citizens are burdened by exactly what you're describing, the very expensive CPA-required audit or interpreted audit by best practices, rather than the onerous terms of an incomplete or incorrect 990. I mean, when the IRS comes after somebody, that's worse than having the state come after them. So I like this. My question being, though, we've got three 990 forms, the N for less than, gross receipts less than 50,000, the easy for up to 500,000, and then the standard form for anything equal to or greater than 500,000. Is there any breakdown of form requirement, or is that just going to be everyone has to fill the 990 out, or are they going to be able to use the form equivalent to their asset group?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I would like to have my staff see if she can identify that.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, you're referring to like the Form 90 EZ and then the full Form 990. And all of the Form 990s were revised in 2008. They all, at some level, ask the same accountability questions, but are tiered to accommodate for smaller budget organizations. And that was a very studied change by the IRS and kind of fairly asked for varying levels of information, but it is still all the same accountable categories.
So follow up. So the intent of this bill then is to allow an organization, whatever they're filed with the IRS, then to use that as the form that they submit to the PIC, CLIC, GIV.
Representative Eisen, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, thank you. I have a couple of comments before I pick up on Representative Keller's point, and that is that I did see here in our packet that we don't have to worry about protecting petunias, that kind of organization, because it is outlined specifically the purpose of the organization, and it kind of prevents that. It's services for youth development, aid and services to the elderly, et cetera. So it does list that. So I just thought I'd make that comment.
I'm not opposed to petunias, by the way.
Yeah, I like petunias too. And also, to Representative Gaddis, the 990s are available online, so you don't even have to go to the organizations anymore to pull them up. You can just look at them, view them to see how they're spending their money. What I want to ask you about is concerned. I understand that we have one of the highest ratios of nonprofits to our population, and so the burden on the PFD division is something where that list could become quite long. And although their purpose, as I mentioned earlier, would have to fall under one of the categories that are outlined, is there something, I remember something else where they have to receive a certain amount of their revenue income via donations, and it seemed like it was pretty high, like 100,000. So that would perhaps not totally open the floodgates where all the very small nonprofits would be added to the list. Am I correct in that assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, you might be referring to the public support test, which is a one-third generally public support test that organizations need to prove for their 990, not for a pick, click, give application. Is that
okay? I remember something about 100,000, but it must not be in relation to this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kreis Tompkins.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. In the Legislative Research Service memo that we received, Ms. Kaplan's testimony in 2007 regarding the Pick, Click, Give program mentioned that there's a certain budget and staffing requirement to qualify. That is for a nonprofit to qualify to participate in Pick, Click, Give. Do you know what that budget and staffing requirement is?
And, Mr. Chairman, again, I'll pass that to my staff, if you don't mind.
Through the chair, Representative Kreis Tompkins, if we could defer to the groups online that are there for questions.
And Mr. Chairman, we do have online both Rasmussen and the 4-Acre Group that are prepared to answer questions if the committee has specific questions.
Which do you believe would be the best one to call next?
For questions or for testimony, Mr. Chairman?
Well, to answer any questions that have been raised here so far.
The 4-Acre Group, I believe, would be the best to answer those questions.
Mr. Mike Walsh, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am on.
Yes, please identify yourself and proceed and try to answer any questions the committee might have.
Yes, good morning. My name is Mike Walsh. I'm the Vice President of Operations at the 4-Acre Group.
And would you tell us what the 4-Acre Group is, please?
Yes, the 4-Acre Group is actually a 501c3 nonprofit. We're called a management support organization. And our job in the state is to strengthen nonprofits, and we do that in a couple of different ways, including education and training, organizational development, and we offer some shared financial human services.
You heard some of the statements and you heard the testimony and some of the questions that come from the committee. Would you like to address any or some of those?
Well, it's a couple of things that have come up. I think the $100,000 question actually relates to the Pick, Click, Give. One of the requirements is that an organization receive 5% or $100,000, at least $100,000 of their revenue from donated sources, and I think that's what the representative was referring to. So I'll stop there and ask if that answers that question.
Okay. Anybody? Questions from the committee here? I see you looking like you're going to ask a question. Representative Isaacson.
Dr. Walsh, thanks for being with us. So just to clarify, because Rep. Hughes had to go testify on her own bill, the clarification was $100,000 or 5% of total annual receipts, whatever is less. So therefore, a senior center, which may not be able to receive $100,000 in contributions, yet if they get 5%, at least 5% of their contributions, they still qualify for this. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative Isaacson, through the chair, first, good morning. And yes, that is correct. It's 5% revenue or $100,000, whichever is lower.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Walsh? Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, for being there. Do you anticipate any kind of a rush on nonprofits trying to qualify, or am I just wondering about something that you think is, you have a good perspective to give me some feedback on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The I guess the simplest response to that is that the process for taking in the applications is online and it's very simple, and there really is very little administrative burden that would be anticipated. You know, the state could answer that more succinctly, but even if there were a larger number, it would still really not be a significant burden.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, sir. Stick around. We may come up with something else.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity to listen in.
Okay. And I'm going to call at this point Mr. Jordan Marshall. Are you there, sir?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Jordan Marshall, Rasmussen Foundation in Anchorage. I serve here as External Affairs Manager. I'm here for answering questions only, sir.
Okay, any questions, Mr. Marshall? Okay, you get off easy this morning. Okay, Ms. Kathleen Light, are you there?
Hello, yes, this is Kathleen Light. I'm the Executive Director of the Ketchikan Area Arts and Humanities Council. Thank you very much for hearing me this morning.
Yes,
I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 75 and to reiterate Representative Seaton's comments. He covered the gamut of the issues for nonprofits with a budget of $250,000 to $500,000 that the annual audit requirement is a financial burden for organizations to participate, and therefore we don't. While the Pick, Click, Give program is an extraordinary program allowing for increased funding for many Alaskan nonprofits and an opportunity for philanthropy for Alaskan citizens, it's actually become a stamp of approval for organizations that participate. But ironically, it's disenfranchising the organizations that are not participating due to this financial burden of the audit. We get many calls in our organization asking us what happened, what's wrong with the organization, why aren't we participating? And we then, when we explain the problem, we never do see those donations from those people because they use the Pick, Click, Give program to give that money to other organizations, which is great, but it does serve to put a little bit of a black mark on the organization. And with the removal of the audit requirement, we can then again participate in this program. Our organization was established in 1953. We've been a nonprofit since 1970. Our budget is about $320,000. We receive grants from our city, from our borough, from the state of Alaska, from the Alaska State Council on the Arts, from the National Endowment for the Arts, from WestAF, and grants from Rasmussen Foundation, as well as the Murdoch Trust. So, and we are not unusual in nonprofits in Alaska that we receive grants from many sources. All of those sources require the 990 form, which is sufficient for them in reviewing our finances and our standing as a good nonprofit. So I hope that will stand as well for the state of Alaska to participate in the Pick, Click, Give program. So thank you very much for letting me speak this morning.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from our committee? If not, thank you very much. And do we have somebody in the audience here from the PFD Corporation? Would it be okay if you came up and respond to any questions we might have?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Angela Rodell, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, representing the Permanent Fund Division.
Okay. Any opening comments you'd like to make or just respond to questions?
No, I'm just available to answer any questions the committee may have.
Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, thanks. You heard the discussion and the questions that I raised. Are you comfortable with the level of eligibility criteria you have now or will have after this is over?
Yes, we are. This will not place any additional administrative burden on the division, and we are perfectly comfortable with the effect this bill may have.
Thank you. And then the follow-up question on that is the current charge is $250 to, file. And the question I really have is what this will do to the number of people that come to you to qualify, right? And I see maybe this is a way we can fill a permanent fund up. No, I'm kidding. What I really want to know is the $250 sufficient if you have, a number of people come? I mean, is that cover the cost of the program for you?
Through the chairman, Representative Keller, it does cover our costs of administering that program, so we are comfortable with the $250 application fee.
Thank you very much, and mm-hmm. I think that's very helpful to the testimony for the sponsor.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was going to look for the fiscal note here. Do we have a fiscal note on this, and what is it, zero?
That is correct, Representative Chair. Lynn, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it is a zero fiscal note from the department.
I get confused myself sometimes here. So it is zero, but even though there'd be obviously more activity than there was before, it would still wouldn't result in any additional cost to the state or to the PFD.
That is correct.
Fine. Thank you very much. Please hang around. We might have think of something else. Dana Paperman, are you there? Is it Paperman or Paperman?
Yes. Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dana Paperman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Seward Senior Center. We have served seniors in social services for 35 years now. On behalf of the center, I'd like to thank Representative Seaton for sponsoring HB 302 in 2012 and bringing it back in 2013 legislative session as HB 75. Thank you, Representative Seaton.
And he's nodding his head. And a return thank you.
Thank you. The Senior Center became a Pick Click Give recipient the first year receiving funds in 2009 at $50, with 100% of the gifts coming from those whom we know personally here at the organization. Into the second year, I diligently worked to market and increase local awareness on the Pick Click Give and also the recipients in our community in Seward in partnership with the Seward Community Foundation, who helped finance direct marketing in the Seward community. Then into our second year, our gifts climbed to $1,100, again from 100% of the friends of the center. But in 2011, our budget grew above the $250,000 mark that requires audit, which is a financial burden on our small senior center. The Pick Click Give program created a valuable avenue for the center to increase our unrestricted funds, which did not create a burden on our staff or operating funds here at the center. Today, we encourage you to accept HB 75 as amended and to help all of our local nonprofits across this great state of Alaska. Thank you for this time this morning.
And thank you for calling in. Any questions for Ms. Paperman? If not, thank you again. Is there anybody else on the line that would like to testify? Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? Okay. If not, I'm going to close public testimony and bring it to the committee for discussion, comments, or whatever. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a good bill, and thanks again to the sponsor for bringing it forward. And I think hopefully the testimony in the minutes will be helpful in the future process of the going through this building. Anyway, if you want, I'm ready to make a motion with some of the comments.
Someone like to make a motion? Representative Gaddis.
Well, I'd like to make a comment as well. And my comment is I think this opens it up for generous Alaskans to give where they want to give. And I think that it just takes away another blockage to allow people to give what they want out of their money. So, I mean, I can't find any problem with this. So I would like to make a motion.
Yes. Will this be your first
this will be
motion
first
in your legislative career?
It will. It will.
Well,
mark it down.
Well, make it good.
I'd like to make a motion that we passed this bill in committee.
Okay, and you're going to have to give the bill number and the version number.
Thank you. I should know better. I'd like to make a motion to pass House Bill number 10 and...
House Bill number 10 might be better.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, I had already gone to the...
I don't know what it is, but...
Don't feel bad. I still...
Yeah, I know.
It's next.
Walk me through this here.
That's what we're doing.
House Bill number 75, and that's 28-LS0323/A.
It'll be /A, right?
/A.
With attached...
With the attached
fiscal.
Zero fiscal note.
Very good. Any objection? If not, the bill passes, and congratulations on the beginning of your... So when I have bills in the future, you can do it properly when I'm going to get it out of committee, okay? Thank you very much. The bill passes without objection. And thank you, Representative Seaton, and your staff for bringing it forward. I think it's a good bill. We're taking at ease while we do the paperwork. Eddie, will please come back to order. Our second bill on today's docket is House Bill number 10, sponsored by Representative Grunberg, formerly of this committee. And I would ask, he is busy in his caucus right now, so his staff, whom we worked with on many different occasions, would like to present the bill. Would you please come forward and identify yourself? And tell us all about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ted Madsen, staff to Representative Max Grunberg. House Bill 10 sets into statute much of the substance of some Attorney General regulations regarding the Executive Branch Ethics Act that were promulgated.
Microphone a little closer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That were promulgated back in December of 2009. However, Representative Grunberg disagreed with two components of those regulations and disagreed with some of the intent behind two of these regulations. Excuse me, not the intent, but the legislative procedure behind a couple of components of this of these regulations. I will touch upon the two disagreements that he had with them, and then I will touch upon the general philosophy that he had in terms of disagreeing with the fact that they set these regulations forward. The first issue that he took was it had to do with the family travel aspect of the regulations that the Attorney General...
The family travel of whom?
The family travel of minor children or the children of the governor or lieutenant governor. Currently in regulation, and I believe in your committee packet, you had a copy of 9 AAC 52.045, transportation of family members or of the governor and lieutenant governor. Currently, minor children are the only ones who are allowed to have their travel costs reimbursed. However, Representative Grunberg feels that it's appropriate that if a child is dependent upon the governor or lieutenant governor for their care. For example, they have a physical, intellectual, or developmental disability, then their travel costs should be reimbursed as well, even if they're over the age of 19. It's just appropriate that the family member is obviously...
So there should be a dependent child...
Yes.
...who, for whatever reason, is dependent upon the mom and dad.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gannis.
What I thought I heard you say, and correct me, but that a dependent child or a dependent adult, did you say the same thing?
I meant adult, both. Please, Ted.
It would be a dependent child who is over the age of 19.
Okay.
So theoretically, it would be a child who's 35 or 40 years old.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That's what I would
hear. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the current regs prohibit payment for the travel of a minor child who is dependent and become an adult?
Representative Keller, through the chair, looking at 9 AAC 52.045, subsection D, Family member means a spouse or minor child of the governor or lieutenant governor. So currently the regulations only stipulate that it can be a minor child.
So this would increase from a minor child to a child over the age of majority, I guess it is, for specific, for reasons such as being dependent for very medical or mental conditions.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. It's a physical or mental disability.
Okay. Representative Keller.
Follow-up. So there's no specific prohibition against paying. In other words, there's some discretion there in spending. Would it be that easy to prevent the executive the branch from spending? I know of specific prohibitions that still get paid for. So anyway, what I'm saying is that there is no prohibition. I realize it isn't covered in that regulation, but that does not necessarily follow that it would be they would be prohibited from paying for the travel of a dependent adult. In fact, what I was thinking is maybe it would be a parent. Maybe a parent, just pick a scenario in your mind. Maybe it was a parent that used to be an official in the state of Alaska, maybe a governor, right? And they had become dependent in their old age. So it'd be a senior citizen would not qualify. So you try to make this and include every scenario that we're going to pay. I'm just wondering, just how big the value is in changing that and putting in the statute.
Representative Keller, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg believes that it is it would be unfair for a governor or lieutenant governor when they are the primary caregiver for their child who is over the age of 19. It would be unfair to unnecessarily divide that family from participating together as a family when this child is dependent upon their mother and father for care. And it's stipulated in the bill about the requirements for when this travel cost can be reimbursed. And I direct your attention to page 3, section 3, lines 19 through 31. And it's very specific when this travel cost can be reimbursed. For example, it has to be a youth or family-oriented event at which the dependent child's attendance would be customary or appropriate.
Thank you.
Would it be like Special Olympics?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be a good example.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that, and it would be unfair. It would be inhuman, of us to do that. But I'm just saying that there is no prohibition, and that with discretion, I believe that the governor could, the executive branch could pay for the travel, they see fit. And I think because it's justifiable, my struggle is whether or not it's justifiable to go through this process and make a statute out of something that's already covered in regulation. No, this one here is not. You're changing the regulation, I understand. But I still wonder if it was necessary, because there's no, for the benefit of the sponsor who just walked in, there's no specific prohibition that I can find that would prevent the executive branch from covering the travel. I realize it's not specifically addressed. Your staff has pointed out very well that it's not specifically addressed in the regulation, but I still say there's no prohibition.
I'd like to welcome Reverend Gruenberg over here. Reverend Gruenberg, we miss you on the committee. I miss you on my left. There's some similarity of appearance. person on my left, I want to make sure anybody's on my left in the future fits the history we have here.
Oh, we're both bald.
Would you like to bring your representative up to date on what we discussed?
I catch the last question.
Okay. Go ahead, please. Introduce yourself. We know who you are, but...
I'm Max Gruenberg, represent District 14, and I'm awfully sorry not to be on the committee. Because then, for one thing, I'd have a vote on this one. Anyway, if I may respond to Representative Keller. You're right. There's nothing that prevents the executive branch from doing what they're doing. I think it's a matter of policy. do you want the executive branch setting their own determination of eligibility, in this case, for travel expenses? I think it's a better idea from a policy point of view that the legislature, which is appropriating the money and is a different branch of government, to have the independent oversight of that through the enactment of a statute. And certainly, we, you and I, can differ on whether that's a good policy. But from a legal point of view, there's no prohibition against them doing it. But I think it's important that we set that policy. If you wish to sit back and let them set their own policy with no legislative oversight, that, of course, is, you know, you can cast your vote that way. But I think it's on a policy basis better for us as a balance of power to, you know, to be heard on the issue, at least to set the statute and to set the parameters generally, for the, in this case, the reimbursement of travel, and in the other case, the question of attorney's fees.
Quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
because of the fact that it'd be very difficult to put in statute every possible scenario that we authorize, there's a limit, you know, we draw the limit. And I think that the spirit of the law right now and the regulation is meant to be a little general and leave discretion. And so anyway, but thank you for the clarification, that helps.
I intended to follow the same parameters that the regulation follows. So it's not a question of being different on the merits. It's a question, as my administrative law professor in law school said, as many of these issues are, who decides? And that's something that we in the legislature, all of us, are constantly faced with. The issue isn't necessarily only what's decided, but the fundamental question, and the question in this case, is who decides? And I think with the balance of power, it's appropriate that the executive branch doesn't decide its own travel regulations, but that the legislature set the policy.
Any comment or question? Representative Gaddis.
You know, I have a question, and I don't know. What I think I'm hearing is that you're putting in or wanting to put into regulation what the rules may be, and what I'm thinking, I'm hearing questions that that they're letting them make the choice what those rules may be. I guess I'm trying to look at it myself. If I'm trying to take a kid with me, either an adult disabled kid or just a young kid because I need to go somewhere and I'm the governor, I sure would like to know what the rules are or what's going to be paid or not, so I just don't get into any mix-ups as we go along. So, I guess I can see both sides, but I'm asking you, if there are rules that would guide me if I was governor taking a kid with me at this time?
There are. The regulation says basically the same thing that the bill says. The only difference between the two, representatives, is that we have included as adult disabled children.
So that's the only difference?
That's the only difference, yeah. The other is a policy basis. I think that it's important, and I've said this a couple of times, that the legislature be the body that establishes the ground rules. I don't have a problem with the merits of what they've done with that one very unusual exception. It's the question of who decides.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Greenberg, thank you for this bill. As having served as an executive of a municipality, I understand that when the public knows clearly what the rules of the road are, as it were, there is much less friction between the legislative, the executive, and the public. And this helps to rectify an issue that needs to be clarified so that we're not in a position where, as if I heard Representative Keller say, the executive branch can just ignore the legislative, you know, the statute authority or something. That's not good policy.
Oops.
So that's not good policy. So I like what you're doing to clarify this, especially since if a child is dependent upon a parent and the child's travel is usual or customary or needed in the situation that, as you or your staff, Ted, described, that child is not split apart and necessarily in a burden on the family. It's not created by trying to follow the letter of the law and give the public true transparency of their actions, but then facing a situation that could be damaging to the family itself or causing an unnecessary burden or something. I suppose they could always
criticism in the media or political opponents.
That's right. I see this as just protecting our executive branch and covering a loophole in a necessary and functional way. And thank you for this.
Any comment? Reverend Keller.
It is a comment, if it's okay. Just a clarification, since I was being lighthearted, trying to be lighthearted and, you know, make funny, but I didn't mean to. We have statute, the executive branch, we rely on them, and their job is to do a responsible job following all our statutes, you know, and spending the money and making the regulations. And as you well know, there's far more regulations than there are statutes. And that was my point, is that the statutes are general and the regulations are more broad. And we, didn't mean to say they can ignore a statute. That's an opinion that I would rather not put on the record one way or the other. but I just wanted to explain, what the obvious is, Representative Grunberg well knows, the line between what's statute and what's law is a difficult one and a subjective one to draw. And the question is how far you can go in specifying policy and statute. And obviously, it has to be a little bit more general than the regulations to pull things out. That was my comment.
Of course, nothing stops the governor, lieutenant governor, from taking such a person with him on any kind of trip, or personal or governmental. But it's a question of who rightly pays for it. Representative Grunberg.
Yes.
You have nothing more to say?
No.
Okay. Press release time. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn, and thank you, Representative Grunberg. I like the fact that you are wanting the legislature to help put this in for the administration. I did have a question, though, just to clarify, as I was reading through the packets in the wee hours of the morning today, before the meeting, if a family member would accompany for a trip, and it is not a youth-oriented or family-oriented event, but family members have customarily accompanied the official in the past, and they were invited, they would then have to pay and were to use, for instance, the governor's jet. I guess we don't have a governor's jet now, but if some kind of transportation was provided by the state, they'd have to reimburse the cost of a equivalent to a airline ticket. Is that correct? Even though they were invited and the family members have customarily attended in the past, if it's not youth or family oriented, they then have to reimburse the state. Is that correct?
No.
It's not correct. Okay.
No. If you would look at page 3 of the bill, lines 17 and following.
Oh, I just saw the or. I thought it was both ands. Okay.
But I want to answer the second part of your question, which I think was a more general question. And that is, what happens if the state owns a plane, which we do, it doesn't happen to be a jet, but it owns a plane, and somebody who's not allowed to be covered under the bill accompanies the governor, then the state wouldn't pay, but what they would do would be figure out the proportional cost of that trip and bill the in this case, the parent, for the taking the child along. And that has happened on occasion. And the person just pays it out of their own expense, their own pocket, reimburses the state. That's how it works.
So, a follow-up? So it's not the equivalent cost of a commercial airline ticket? It's a proportional cost for the whole?
I believe so. I'm not an expert on this. And yes, we can certainly find that out. What did you say to that? Okay, go ahead. Get his answer on that.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, once again, 9 AAC 52.045, subsection C, except for transportation by state aircraft for partisan political purposes under 39.52, the agency that authorized or paid for the travel shall determine the cost of the transportation based either on the actual fare paid or the fare of equivalent commercial transportation if the travel was by state aircraft, vessel, or vehicle.
Okay, I think that's better. The proportional cost of the whole transportation might be quite a bit higher, so that's good. Okay, thank you.
Please correct my record.
Any other questions? No, we have Judy Bachman. Are you in the audience or online?
I'm on the line, Representative Bruin and the chair.
Yes. Would you care to offer any comments or be available for questions on this issue?
I'm available for questions if the chair or the members have a question.
Please identify yourself with the Assistant Attorney General. Which section over there?
Yes, my name is Judy Bachman. I'm Assistant Attorney General in the Opinions, Appeals, and Ethics section, and I serve as the function of the State Ethics Attorney.
Okay, any questions?
Yeah.
For her? Representative Keller.
Thank you, Judy. Would you explain the way the Ethics Committee works in the executive branch, how it gets appointed, who's not specifically by name, but I mean where the source of complaints can be, come from, can the Ethics Committee file them, are they all public, that kind of information, just general background.
Representative Keller, through the chair, and that's a huge question, but there isn't actually as such an ethics committee. The way the Ethics Act has structured this is it sets out the various provisions and prohibitions, the code of conduct, if you will, in the Act. The complaint process starts with filing a complaint with the Attorney General, and if the process proceeds as far as it might, the matter may end up before the State Personnel Board, unless, of course, it's a complaint against the Governor, Lieutenant Governor, or Attorney General, in which case it is immediately referred to the Board, who then appoints the Independent Counsel to investigate. And so that's the short version. We, of course, have the statute in place since 1986 with amendments a couple of times over time. And then there are regulations that have also been adopted over time to provide additional rules or parameters with respect to certain portions of the statute.
And this would apply to both the current public official, such as the governor, general governor, and former public officers of the same type?
Through the chair, I think the answer to the question is yes. Ethics Act itself applies principally to conduct while a person is in state service. This is only the executive branch, meaning all executive branch appointees, employees, and boards and commission members. There are a couple of provisions that do restrict, have some restrictions on you after you leave state service, but principally it applies to conduct while in office or in your state position.
Because I see in the title on line three, middle of line three, is it allowing certain public officers and former public officers to accept state payments, et cetera? That's part of I'm referring
yes,
to.
Yes, to the chair. Our regulation and Representative Gruenberg's bill both recognize that the possibility that a former state officer could be the subject of an ethics complaint for conduct while in office, and the attorney's fees provisions covers that individual. The regulation, and I believe the statute as proposed, do not cover a former employee's violation of one of those provisions that apply after they leave state service. And so that kind of person, someone violating the act after they leave state service, do not get the benefit of the either the regulatory provision or the bill if it is adopted.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Bachman and members of the committee here. If the members would look at the final section of the bill, section 5 on page 5, lines 5 through 9, that the legislation, only the section 4 of the legislation, only applies to complaints that are initiated or filed on or after the effective date of the act. And that's talking about the attorney's fees. The transportation would apply to applications that are made after the effective date. There's no retroactivity clause.
I think Reverend Keller.
Yeah, if I could, I think we didn't get to the point where your staff or you have described the second thing
right.
that is being done, you know, to the regulations. Well, if I understood, I just want to recap to make sure I understand here. You said that the this is all in regulation already, and what we're doing is looking at a couple policy decisions that are very specific because we're trying to change what the regulations say and what currently exists, right? And that, you know, that we're, well, let me stop then. We need to, I guess, the rest of your presentation so we understand the second thing that is on there.
Okay, I thought we're focusing on the first part of the bill here.
Maybe so. Maybe I am confusing the
issue.
Well,
maybe I have to, you know.
And I'll get into this.
We have to look at it in total.
Sure.
Like when you're talking about the first part.
The first part just adopts the regs in statute, except for the developmentally disabled kid.
I understand that.
Now, there is one thing. Do we have that? Representative Millett was going to offer an amendment to this very part of the bill, and I wonder if we could pass this out. She has put in legislation which is supported by the developmentally disabled community, and I've co-sponsored it. And where's the amendment there? It brings up to date the definition of the term mental disability. And this is what the community would like us to use throughout. Her bill will change it throughout the statutes, but because it is used in this particular bill, and I'm referring, you don't have a copy of that? Could we have another copy of that, Nancy?
So, as I understand it, Reverend Gruenberg, if for whatever reason her bill does not pass, then it would still make that change in your bill?
Yeah, on page 3, line 12, it would, instead of saying mental disability, it would say, quote, intellectual or developmental. And I would be grateful if the committee would adopt that.
Would anybody like to offer that amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
Yes, I'll make that amendment, and if I do this correctly. So I move to amend HB 10, version 28-LS0040, /A.2, I believe. No, it's /A. On page 3, line 12, delete or mental, and insert intellectual or developmental as we have in front of us on this written amendment.
Is there any objection? If not, amendment 1 is passed.
Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Should we go on to the second part of the bill now?
Yes, go to the second part now.
The second.
We can always return to the first. We can always return to the first part.
Yes, sir. The second adopts another regulation.
What page are we on here with that?
We're talking about Section 4 of the bill on pages 4 and 5.
Okay, please continue.
This deals with the ability for somebody who is exonerated to recoup their costs and attorney's fees in defending against an ethics complaint. And again, this only applies to people in the executive branch, but it applies to all the people in the executive branch. The first part of the bill only applies to the families of the governor and lieutenant governor. So this applies to everybody from the governor down to the person who's sweeping the Capitol building or whatever it is.
Who's just as important as the governor? Who's just as important as the governor?
More important if they're my constituent. Or yours. I can tell you a story about that, but I won't. A true story. The difference between this regulation, the regulation, and this bill is that under the regulation, the person can apply and receive payments even before they're exonerated. This requires the person to have been exonerated. And this is the normal practice in this state. If you're sued civilly or you sue and you prevail, you apply for your costs and attorney's fees after the judgment is entered, after the judgment's rendered. And on the judgment form, it says judgment's rendered for the plaintiff in the amount of blank dollars or for the defendant and the case is dismissed. And in addition, the whoever that is awarded blank dollars in costs and blank dollars in attorney's fees. And then the judge entertains a motion for that. Actually, the clerk determines the cost, the judge determines the attorney's fees, and they fill it in at that point. You cannot get paid before the final result in the case, because until that time, you don't know who wins. And actually, sometimes the case is reversed on appeal, and then they reverse the award of attorney's fees, and they go through the retrial, and then they re-decide it. But particularly, that's the policy in this state. And secondly, if you award money in advance, the person may not prevail. And then you'll have to try to chase them and get the money back, which is unseemly, a waste of time, and we might as well get the whole thing taken care of at once.
Question? No questions?
No, yeah.
Reverend Keller.
Ms. Bachman described the process of the complaints. Just one more, I believe she's still online, and you could probably answer this. At what point could a person potentially begin to accumulate a legal debt because of a complaint? It would be once the complaint goes to the Attorney General, the first thing. And I would assume at that point that the person that is being complained against is kept in that loop. And so then it's a matter of discretion for that person whether or not he hires legal counsel or not. Am I right?
Through the chair, essentially, yes.
Identify yourself, please.
This is Judy Bachman again. The process is that when a complaint is first received, we do a preliminary review and analysis to determine whether it states appropriate Ethics Act claims and warrants investigation. At that point, the subject is not necessarily immediately informed, but if we determine to accept the complaint, formally accept it, then the statute requires that it be served on the subject and the investigation would proceed. And then most investigations are resolved at some level in this investigatory phase, although the statute provides, and occasionally we do go forward to the more formal public accusation that might lead to a hearing. In my experience, most subjects don't immediately hire an attorney when they're served with a complaint. It of course depends on the situation, and in those cases where attorneys have been involved early, it seems the situation is clearly more serious than others, but that's the process. The subject obviously has the right to hire an attorney whenever they first find out about a complaint as they wish. In my experience, with other than in the most serious circumstances of complaints, they don't automatically do that. If it got to the public accusation phase without otherwise resolving, I would expect most folks would hire an attorney, but maybe not.
Thank you. Representative Hughes?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. And this is probably for Judy on the phone, but Representative Gruenberg, I'll address it to you. And that is the fiscal note says zero, but there could be a cost to the state if it's paying for these legal fees. And so my question is, historically, how many have gone out and hired a private attorney? And so do we have any idea, you know, how many do that and what the cost could be to the state?
Reverend Gruenberg.
Ms. Bachman, I'm going to ask you to answer the question as to the amount involved, and then I'm going to answer the question on a different level.
Okay, and then I would just another little thing. Does the state provide attorney services to the individual so that they wouldn't have to hire an attorney within the department?
Is the question directed to
Ms. Bachman?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Hughes, through the chair. The fiscal note is zero because it doesn't impact this Department of Law, both on the transportation costs as well as the attorney fees, because the way I understand it to be set up at this point is, for example, in the governor's office, they have an administrative account that's addressed in the budget process and appropriations process every year, and they have their funds. Those transportation costs are covered within that funding, and then the attorney's fees situation is covered through the Department of Administration's Department of Risk Management, and I believe, if I understand the process correctly, the Department of Administration provides the fees payment through interagency assessment. So if there was a particular person subject to an ethics complaint who chose to avail himself of this attorney's fees benefit, it would be addressed through the Division of Risk Management and that person's agency. The historical information, I will say that there are instances, as you well can imagine, where state employees are the subject of various kinds of complaints, not just ethics complaints. And there are circumstances in which, and I'm not fully educated on all of the parameters, but in which a defense might be provided in the context of whatever the lawsuit is. There are also, in addition to the Ethics Act proceedings, other proceedings which can challenge, say, a hearing officer's make a conflict challenge or bring a complaint, I believe, under the hearing officer's procedures and perhaps something else. And so there's more than just the Ethics Act, but for the purposes of the Ethics Act, the regulations have only been in place since December 2010, as was said earlier. And as far as I know, since to date, there haven't been anybody to seek reimbursement of attorney's fees costs. I was thinking back over the matters, two significant matters involving attorneys. In both instances, the individual was not exonerated. That there may be one I'm thinking of, but I no longer have the file, where there a smaller complaint that was dismissed where there was an attorney involved. But I'm not aware that there have been any requests for reimbursement of attorney's fees since the regulations went into effect.
Follow-up, Chairman? A follow-up?
Representative
Hughes.
Hughes. I know, I'm trying to keep it straight here, who's after each other.
I
had Christ Tompkins, and then, yeah, go ahead first.
You said that the if there were a case where attorney fees under this would be reimbursed or paid, that it would come out of the risk, I don't know what you call it, risk management fee part of their budget. My question is there any limit in what would be paid to attorney fees in statute? Are there any limits that would might apply to this?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, there is the Department of Administration Division of Risk Management back in, let's see, August of 2009, put into place, and I guess it's a policy, so I don't know that it is in statute anywhere, a cap of $25,000 per proceeding, regardless of the number of claims made, and that's my understanding of the current cap. But I believe it's by policy of the division. At least I have a copy of their policy, and I don't see a citation to another authority.
Thank you.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
More of a comment. My understanding of the bill is that how or under what circumstances attorney's fees are paid out isn't affected by this bill. It's simply a question of when. So under current regulation, there may or may not be a limit to the amount of attorney's fees paid out, but just make sure that if somebody is exonerated for an ethics charge, that they actually get paid after they've actually been exonerated, aren't preemptively exonerated.
So in other words, as the complaint is progressing through the system, that's taken care of through the risk management or otherwise, and if perchance they are exonerated, then at that point the person or the risk management would be reimbursed. Is that correct?
May I respond?
Yes, Reverend Gruenberg.
That is, and may I respond to both the representative's questions. The use of fiscal notes is very complicated and not entirely consistent, and I will just reserve my comments on that for another day. But the general rule is that you only look at the effect of the bill. And the only effect of the bill is actually an unknown amount, which will probably potentially save the state money, because it will protect against a circumstance where somebody applies during the pendency of the case and then are not exonerated, and the state would have to chase this person, spend money to get the money back, and may very well not recoup all of their money. It's an unknown amount and highly speculative, and a zero fiscal note is very appropriate because nothing else has changed. Right now, under the regulations, they can see their costs and fees. This just makes sure they're not paid erroneous.
Thank you.
Representative Keller.
I'm sorry.
You have more?
Well, I thought you had another question. Oh, the amount that's involved. If you look at the bill is on bottom of page 4, line 31, up to the top of page 5. It doesn't set an amount in dollars and cents. It requires that they be reasonable and related to the cost of legal representation that are necessarily incurred. So they have to be three things. They have to be reasonable, they have to be related to the cost of defense, and they have to be necessarily incurred. And my recollection is that in the regulatory process, as they did the regulation, and I was involved a little bit with Ms. Bachman in helping on the regulations, that was tightened up. And that's the general standard under Rule 82. They have to be reasonable, they have to be involved in the litigation, and they have to be necessarily incurred so that they're not frivolous.
Reasonable is in the eyes of the judge.
That's exactly right. And they look at, under the regulations here, which will still be in place, and we're looking at the regulations, which is 9 AAC 52.040, sub D2. Expenses are reasonable if, based on an evaluation of the complexity of the alleged claim, the attorney's fees or hourly rate, the hours expended, the relationship between the amount of work performed and the significance of the alleged claim, and other relevant factors, the expenses were necessarily incurred to defend against an allegation and a complaint. And then they include attorney's fees and delegated fees that are performed by an attorney's investigator, paralegal, that sort of thing, law clerk. And the if the complaint alleges more than one violation, and they're apportioned, then they can be apportioned based on count one or count two, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't go into that detail in the statute because that's covered in the regs. And as you were talking about, Representative Keller, earlier, we don't get into that detail normally in the regs, as Representative Keller knows, as the former head of the Administrative Regulation Review Committee, I think, right? Yeah. Okay.
I'd like to let the record show Representative Miller has joined us. Do you have any follow-up, Representative Keller?
It's a question. I want to go back a ways and ask the sponsor a question. You said that this is normal in the court system, that the there's no money paid until after the exoneration. Is it normal in the context of the ethics world, where you have ethics complaints in other states and whatever? Let me finish my question before you respond, please. I'm going to pose the possibility that this can be a political, that ethics complaints can be used as a political tool in the toolbox of various organizations. If, for example, a political organization puts out the word and says, okay, we got to have lots of complaints filed, that may or may not have an effect on the AG, but we know that the media is involved at a different level than what it normally is in the courts, and this becomes a matter of public opinion, that affects the results, or can affect the results of what happens with an ethics complaint. So my concern with this bill, frankly, is that it removes, ultimately, and you can respond to this. My question is to go back to see if there's other areas where there's ethics laws and committees and what have you, if that's normal in that context, or did you mean the broad context of the whole court? But my real concern, like I say, is the fact that this can be used as a political tool, and another question that I have, just to put it on the record, is whether or not it's appropriate to remove the option that the, in this case, the executive branch would have of essentially protecting an employee that maybe became a target of something that was political. And I think the passage of this bill would prevent that kind of coverage, and this kind of goes back to your comment. Yeah, it's a matter of when, but it's also a matter of the cash out front. In other words, if this bill does not pass, then government, the executive branch, has the option of putting the money out there to protect, to help protect its employee. If this bill were to pass, then that upfront money would be in the, the responsibility of the person that is accused. And so, it's a question that's subjective because, and there is a specific in there, and I'm pretty sure Representative Gruenberg got it, and if not, I'll repeat it. But I wanted to build that box to put it in so you understand better. But did that, was that enough, or do you want me to restate the question?
Yeah, I think it's a
that's very more than enough
question of what could happen and perhaps has happened.
You asked several questions. I hope I get them all. Okay. It's like going after a skeet. You try to get them, but you do the best you can. Or ducks. The question is, one of the questions you asked had to do with malicious or frivolous or vexatious litigation. Another question had to do with what is the practice in other states. Another is had to do with what's the practice now. I would like to focus on the last question first. The practice before any regulation came about here was like in criminal law. There was no reimbursement for anything. And it was worse than criminal law. Because to answer your other question, Representative Hughes, there's no public attorney appointed to represent the defendant in an ethics case. It's not like the public defender or the Office of Public Advocacy has any statutory provision that allows them to represent these folks. They've been entirely on their own. And when Governor Palin was hit with a bunch of litigation, I think that brought people's attention to the fact that there should be some method of dealing with this. And what the Attorney General decided to do when they published their regulation was not to provide a public attorney for this person, but to provide a method of reimbursing a private attorney for the reasonable amount of the fees. So this is entirely different than even under the Legislative Ethics Act, we can be hit with zillions of meritless complaints, and we wouldn't get a dime. There wouldn't be anybody who defends us. Fortunately, that hasn't happened. And I think the cases against Governor Palin made it a poster child of how this could be abused. Secondly, the question was, whether it could be unfair, the person could be potentially, like Governor Palin, really put to a heck of an expense. And I will admit that that's a possibility. I think the possibility is more remote than the possibility if they're reimbursed in advance that they would not be exonerated. Ms. Bachman just said there have been a handful of complaints, and most of them were found to have merit. And would not be merit. Were meritless, and they never went to the adjudication phase. They died in the investigation phase, and under most circumstances, that is done in house, at least in the Legislative Ethics Act, done in house. And there's no need to defend against yourself and really put a lot of fees into it at that point. They're snarfed in the bud, so to speak. And the circumstance has not arisen that is contemplated here by this bill, that somebody is charged and then they apply for fees and then they're found guilty of the ethics infraction. That is something that I think is a much, if they go that far in the process, there's probable cause already established, and they're already well into the process, and the chance at that point of being exonerated is much lower than it would be just when the complaint is filed, because they've determined that there's probable cause. So if you reimburse somebody early on in the process, the chance of having to recoup it because they're found guilty is much greater than a situation like the Governor Palin, I'm going to call it that circumstance. That was, I would say, once in a blue moon situation. I'm not aware of that ever having occurred in the history of statehood. And frankly, the remedy for something like that is a different remedy. It's a problem, a remote problem, but a problem. And what would need to be looked at is something that's beyond the scope of this bill, but it's something that has troubled courts for a long time, and that's how you deal with a vexatious litigant. And we have people who make a habit of litigating. They don't like the court system. Maybe they've had a bad result in a domestic relations case. Who knows? But they file case after case after case. And the courts do have the authority under the common law to require them to put up a bond or have a pre-screening, this sort of thing, but they use it very, very rarely. And it apparently hasn't happened enough to excite the attention of anybody to have something for vexatious litigants here. We grappled with this in the field of legislative ethics. Oh, I want to say it was about 7 years ago. And Representative Lynn, you'll remember when we did that, about keeping these things muzzled and private until there was probable cause.
I don't like the word muzzled.
Private. And that we grappled with that, but that was an entirely different remedy than the attorney's fees. And I think that the reason we're doing this is because the chance of not being exonerated is much greater, and we deal with that with the attorney's fees, and somebody may want to deal with vexatious litigants later, but it's not within the scope of the bill.
Just a real quick follow-up.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, in your opinion, Representative Gruenberg, does this bill expand the potency potential of a vexatious complaint?
I don't think it would directly affect it either way, because you're dealing with a third person there. That's the person who initiates the complaint. And whether this person gets his attorney's fees reimbursed in the case or later in the case, you have the state involved at that point. The state, under the Executive Ethics Act, is prosecuting this. It's almost quasi-criminal. It's not a criminal thing. But it's like if you file a complaint against somebody, criminal complaint, then the police investigate it, the district attorney prosecutes it, but it's the state versus you. It's not Joe Doakes who was the alleged victim.
Okay, thank you. It seems to me that we have almost two separate bills here. You know, the first part dealing with the governor, lieutenant governor, being able to do what should be done, you know, without harm for a child or for a disabled person of whatever age, and this is just two separate things almost to me, and I don't know that they belong in the same bill, but maybe they do. Let me ask you, is anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody in the audience who would like to testify? If not, I'll close public testimony and bring it to the committee. A lot of interesting points have been raised here. Speaking personally, I'm very much in favor of the first section of this bill. I think it has merit. It may not apply to any governor, to any governor for the next 50, 100 years. You know, who knows? But I think it's a very valid point. The other part may also be valid, but it seems to me it raises a lot of questions, and I think the questions have merit, but I think it needs to be dug into more deeply than we have time to do it here today. So I wonder, got any other comments from the committee or anything? She beat you to the punch here. Representative Gaddis and then Representative Isaacson.
Actually, I was pointing him out, but I'll take it first. Thank you. I guess my comments are this on the second part. I guess the way I see it is that if there are frivolous ethics complaints, I'm hearing it said that those are ferreted out by the ethics committee and so on and so forth. So, you know, certainly that would be my concern, that frivolous ethics complaints, that you don't have to shell out your own money to get those dealt with. and then get repaid at a later date. So I think that has been covered. I also think that if it is not a frivolous ethic complaint and that you have to hire your own attorney, our constituents have to do the same thing, and I think that they're looking at us to have the same rules. And that's what I'm hearing said, and anybody correct me if they hear it differently, but that's what I'm challenged with when I'm listening to this, thinking that, gee, our folks, they go to the same courts and have to go with the same rules, and they'd like to see us follow those same things. And that's what I think I'm hearing. So that's my comment.
Yes. Reverend Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like what the preceding comment was.
The privilege, of course, in the eyes of the beholder.
Sure. The idea of vexatious, and that's a one that I've struggled with. As the sponsor of this bill has pointed out, it's not something necessarily that this bill is intended to do. But what it can do, in my estimation, is it notifies the complainant that if they make it through the executive branch executive ethics process, that the vexatious person is just trying to either make life difficult or expensive for the person sitting in that office, and this will let them know that no, they're not going to bleed the let's say governor's individual funds at this moment, because if the governor prevails, then they're going to be reimbursed. And I think what we saw in part in the Palin incident was people trying to bleed her dry, and ultimately perhaps they achieved their ultimate goal and forced her to go for book royalties or something. That's not what we want our executives to have to endure or go through. For that purpose, I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, that this may be two bills, but I can support both of these bills or both aspects of this, because in my mind, it provides real clear instructions to all involved what the rules of the road are. And as an executive and as a member of the public, you want to have that. And so I would support this.
Anybody else? Reverend Christ Tompkins.
I would just echo the comments, the two preceding comments.
The what now?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's my understanding if somebody's filing a blizzard of vexatious complaints, I too like the word vexatious, a great vocabulary addition to my morning. It seems as though that would merely bleed the complainant dry, because all those complaints would be found meritless, and that complainant would then be paying through the nose. It's just a question of when, and to me, this bill, or rather the second part of this bill, merely aligns when that money is paid out for executive branch people with members of the general public, and seems very logical and just a question of good housekeeping.
Anybody else? I think there have been some questions, asked on it. To me, the first part of this bill is rather cut and dried. The second part, there are various opinions on this, and I understand both sides of this. And I think, in the interest of time here, so we don't act precipitously, let's hold the bill today and consider having another hearing on it in the reasonably near future, if that meet the approval of the committee. Okay? Yeah. I'd like to thank you for bringing it forward. I think it's a timely bill, maybe not for some of the people involved in the past, but these are things that we all deal with. This deals with administrative branch, but of course we can be subject to this in the legislative branch as well by these kinds of individuals. So with that, I'd like to thank you for bringing the bill forward. It's very, very interesting, and it needs to be considered. Is there any other business to come before the committee this morning? If not, I'd like to thank everybody for your participation. And we don't have the schedule put together for the next hearing. There'll be no committee hearing on Saturday. There will be a we expect to have a meeting on Tuesday, and you'll get notice of what it is. No other business before the committee? We are adjourned.